The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Associated Press and the Religion News Service. Our first article was published on October 1 by the Associated Press and written by Nicole Winfield and Tricia Thomas, entitled, Pope Francis Creates 21 New Cardinals to Help Reform Church, Vatican City. Pope Francis created 21 new cardinals at a ritual-filled ceremony on Saturday, September 30, including key figures at the Vatican and in the field who will help enact his reforms and cement his legacy as he enters a crucial new phase in running the Catholic Church. On a crisp, sunny morning filled with cheers from St. Peter's Square, Francis further expanded his influence on the College of Cardinals, who will help him govern and one day elect his successor. With Saturday's additions, nearly three-quarters of the voting age princes of the Church owe their red hats to the Argentine Jesuit. In his instructions to the new cardinals at the start of the service, Francis said their variety and geographic diversity would serve the Church like musicians in an orchestra, where sometimes they play solos, sometimes as an ensemble. Diversity is necessary. It is indispensable. However, each sound must contribute to the common design, Francis told them. This is why mutual listening is essential. Each musician must listen to the others. Among the new cardinals was the controversial new head of the Vatican's Doctrine Office, Victor Manuel Fernandez, and the Chicago-born missionary now responsible for vetting bishop candidates around the globe, Robert Prevost. Also entering the exclusive club were the Vatican's ambassadors to the United States and Italy, two important diplomatic posts where the Holy See has a keen interest in reforming the Church hierarchy. Leaders of the Church in geopolitical hotspots like Hong Kong and Jerusalem, fragile communities like Juba, South Sudan, and sentimental favorites like Cordoba, Argentina, filled out the roster. Francis' promotions of Prevost and his ambassador to Washington, French Cardinal Christophe Pierre, were clear signs that he has an eye on shifting the balance of power in the U.S. hierarchy, where some conservative bishops have strongly resisted his reforms. Between them, Pierre and Prevost are responsible for proposing new bishop candidates and overseeing any investigations into problem ones already in place. I think I do have some insights into the Church in the U.S., Prevost said, after the ceremony, during a welcome reception in the Apostolic Palace. So the need to be able to advise, work with Pope Francis, and to look at the challenges that the Church in the U.S. is facing, I hope to be able to respond to them with a healthy dialogue. The ceremony took place days before Francis opens a big meeting of the bishops and lay Catholics on charting the Church's future, where hot-button issues such as women's roles in the Church, LGBTQ+ Catholics, and priestly celibacy are up for discussion. The October 4 through 29 Synod is the first of two sessions. The second one comes next year. That in many ways could cement Francis' legacy as he seeks to make the Church a place where all are welcomed, where pastors listen to their flocks and accompany them rather than judge them. Several of the new cardinals are voting members of the synod and have made clear they share Francis's vision of a church that is more about the people in the pews than the hierarchy, and that creative change is necessary. Among them is Fernandez, known as the Pope's theologian, and perhaps Francis's most consequential Vatican appointment in his 10-year pontificate. In his letter naming Fernandez as prefect of the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, Francis made clear he wanted his fellow Argentine to oversee a radical break from the past, saying the former Holy Office often resorted to immoral methods to enforce its will. Rather than condemn and judge, Francis said he wanted a doctrine office that grounds the faith and gives people hope. He also made clear Fernandez wouldn't have to deal with sex abuse cases, saying the office's discipline section could handle that dossier. It was a much-debated decision, given Fernandez himself has admitted he made mistakes handling a case while he was bishop in La Plata, Argentina, and that the scale of the problem globally has long cried out for authoritative, high-ranking leadership. On the eve of the consistory to make Fernandez a cardinal, clergy abuse survivors, including a La Plata victim, rallied near the Vatican, calling on Francis to rescind the nomination. No bishop who has covered up child sex crimes and ignored and dismissed victims of clergy abuse in his diocese should be running the office that oversees, investigates, and prosecutes clergy sex offenders from around the world, or be made a cardinal, said Julieta Anasco, the La Plata survivor, according to a statement from the End Clergy Abuse. With Saturday's ceremony, Francis will have named 99 of the 137 cardinals who are under age 80, and thus eligible to vote in a future conclave to elect his successor. While not all are cookie-cutter protégés of the 86-year-old reigning pontiff, many share Francis' pastoral emphasis, as opposed to the doctrine-minded cardinals often selected by Popes John Paul II and Benedict XVI. Such a huge proportion of Francis' nominated cardinals almost ensures that a future pope will either be one of his own cardinals or one who managed to secure Franciscan cardinal votes to lead the church after he is gone, suggesting a certain community and continuity in priorities. Europe still has the most voting age cardinals with 52, followed by the Americas with 39, and Asia with 24. Our next article was published by the Religion News Service on September 19, written by Bob Smetana, and entitled, Despite Remaining Leaderless, SBC Executive Committee Says It Had Most Unified Meeting in Some Time, Nashville, Tennessee. The Southern Baptist Convention's Executive Committee lost another leader before he could even get started. Meeting in Nashville, trustees from the Executive Committee had hoped to approve retired Kentucky pastor Dan Summerlin as interim president and CEO. But during an executive session on Tuesday, September 19, trustees learned Summerlin had withdrawn as a candidate. Louisiana pastor Philip Robertson said Summerlin had come to the conclusion that, at this particular time, this job might be a little bit more than he could handle. During a news conference, Robertson read a statement from Summerlin. Upon further reflection, it has become evident that what is best for the convention and for my family is to withdraw my name from consideration at this time, Summerlin said. Summerlin would have been the committee's sixth leader in the past 5 years, and his withdrawal marks the second time this year that a nomination for leader of the executive committee has fallen apart. In May, a search committee had nominated Texas pastor Jared Wellman, a former committee chair, as the permanent president. But a vote on Wellman failed the same month. The committee has been without a permanent leader for 2 years, ever since former Arkansas megachurch pastor Ronnie Floyd resigned as CEO and president after a fierce battle over how to conduct an investigation into the SBC's handling of sexual abuse. Willie McLaurin had been serving as interim CEO but resigned last month after admitting he had falsified his resume. The fraud was discovered while McLaurin was being vetted as a candidate for the permanent role. Robertson, chair of the committee, reported that after an internal investigation, trustees had decided to take no legal action against McLaurin at this time. Based on the findings from the internal investigation, while it is clear that Willie McLaurin engaged in both academic and professional fraud during his tenure with the executive committee, no evidence was found of financial wrongdoing or direct harm to the executive committee, according to a committee statement. The committee also reached a confidential separation agreement with McLaurin. Robertson declined to discuss any details of the agreement, including possible financial compensation, citing HR concerns. He did say that, in general, separation agreements can be helpful in cases like this. Robertson also told trustees that the officers who deal with human relations matters had adopted a new vetting process for leaders, including verifying academic credentials, past employment, and military service, and any professional licenses. After an extended executive session, Robertson also announced that Metoka Baptist Church in Oshawada, Oklahoma, had been deemed not in friendly cooperation with the convention based on a lack of intent to cooperate in resolving concerns regarding discriminatory behavior on the basis of ethnicity. Earlier this year, photos of the pastor of Metoka Baptist Church in blackface and impersonating the late Ray Charles reportedly surfaced, prompting outrage. According to television station K2UL, the pastor defended the photos and was unapologetic. The SBC removed a Georgia Baptist church for similar reasons in 2018. Despite the troubles of the executive committee and the uncertainty over its leadership, the tone of the meeting was markedly different from earlier meetings that had been characterized by tension and sometimes open conflict. Both Robertson and SBC President Bart Barber said at the news conference that trustees seemed united in their desire to work together and address their current challenges. Barber called it the most unified meeting in some time. Barber added that many Southern Baptists have experienced complicated leadership transitions at their local churches, and that affects how they view the executive committee. Our next article was published by the Religion News Service on September 20, written by Bob Smetana and Jack Jenkins, and entitled, Jerry Falwell's Legal Battle with Liberty University and His Brother Escalates. The ongoing legal battle between Liberty University and Jerry Falwell Jr. has taken yet another twist, with the disgraced former president of the school alleging misconduct by its board of directors and attempting to ban the university from using images of his late father. In an amended complaint filed in federal court, Falwell Jr., who resigned from his post in August 2020 in the wake of multiple scandals, alleged that several board members, including former interim Liberty president Jerry Prevo and former Southern Baptist Convention president Jerry Vines, diverted university funds to their private causes. During his lifetime, Dr. Falwell earned a reputation as a major proponent of financial integrity in religious and educational institutions, and led the way in restoring public trust and confidence in such institutions after financial scandals associated with other unrelated church leaders rocked the evangelical community in the 1980s, Falwell Jr.'s lawyer argued in the amended complaint filed September 13. The reference to Dr. Falwell is to Jerry Falwell Sr. The Jerry Falwell brand will not be associated with such conduct. Falwell Jr. also alleges the board overlooked sexual misconduct by former leaders, including an unnamed former president, only to turn on Falwell Jr. when his life fell apart. Falwell Jr. also alleges the board exploited a near-fatal lung condition he suffered, and harassed him by not paying him retirement benefits. The Jerry Falwell brand does not stand for such abhorrent treatment, which is antithetical to the reputation by which it is known, the complaint alleges. The complaint lays much of the blame at the feet of Prevost, who the complaint alleges diverted school funds to his personal foundation and used the school's corporate jet to fly to his homes in Alaska and Arizona, $35,000 per trip and $20,000 per trip, respectively. Falwell also alleges Prevost made many of his decisions after consulting with evangelical leader Franklin Graham. Upon information and belief, Franklin Graham is Prevost's closest advisor. During the limited times Prevost appeared on campus to fulfill his duties as interim president, he would speak with Graham virtually every day by phone before making any decisions, the complaint alleges. Asked about the complaint, a Liberty University spokesperson sent RNS a statement. In response to Liberty's compelling motion to dismiss his complaint, Jerry Falwell Jr. filed an amended complaint containing improper and unsupported allegations designed to diminish former colleagues, family, and friends, and to discredit the university where he formerly served, the statement read. These personal attacks have no place in a legal dispute over the use of a person's name, image, and likeness. Liberty will file the appropriate response to these claims in due time and defend its legal right to continue the use of Dr. Jerry Falwell's name. Furthermore, we stand by our initial statement that Liberty University and its Board of Trustees have only sought to honor the visionary leadership of Dr. Jerry Falwell, and the mission of training champions for Christ. In addition to the complaint, RNS obtained from multiple sources an email sent by Falwell Jr. to Liberty board members discussing the latest legal filing. In the email, Falwell accuses David Corey, Liberty's general counsel, of waging a three-year campaign to use millions of dollars of Liberty student tuition money to make me look as bad as possible in public and to the Board of Trustees. Falwell also accused Corey of malpractice and incompetence and suggested some members of Liberty's executive committee want to gain control of Liberty, benefit personally from Liberty, and determine who will be Liberty's future leaders. Later in his email, Falwell claimed he had intended to end the legal battle, but had no choice but to strike back this spring to protect my family's reputation and future after forgiving 7 times 70, apparently referencing a biblical quote from Jesus about how many times to forgive enemies. The back and forth touches primarily on one of two lawsuits making their way through federal court. In March, the former Liberty president sued the university and the executive committee of the school's board, alleging they have failed to pay him $8.5 million in retirement benefits. Those benefits, the suit alleges, could only be withheld if he were fired for cause or if he engaged in any competitive activity, according to the complaint filed in U.S. District Court for the Western District of Virginia. The board alleges the retirement benefits should be forfeited because Falwell deceived them regarding his own personal failings and his and his wife's fiscal and alleged immoral behavior with a young man named Giancarlo Granda. Most damaging of all, perhaps, was Falwell's post-contractual revelation of his overall and disqualifying departure from Liberty's core Christian values at the time he was in the process of being Liberty's long-term spiritual leader, the school lawyers argued in a filing this month. In July, Falwell sued the school again for using his father's name, image, and portrait, all of which are trademarked, without permission of the Dr. Jerry L. Falwell Family Trust, which owns the trademark. The lawsuit pits the Falwell brothers against each other. Jerry Falwell Jr. alleges that his brother, Jonathan Falwell, betrayed the family trust by siding with the university against him in regard to the trademark, and is doing so for personal gain, and that Jonathan Falwell convinced their sister to have Jerry Falwell removed as a co-trustee of the family trust. He also says the school rescued Thomas Road Baptist, where Jonathan Falwell succeeded their father as pastor, from financial ruin, and that this brother hides how much money he gets from the school. Upon information and belief, Liberty and Jonathan have colluded to avoid publicly reporting additional income that Jonathan receives from Liberty, whether directly or indirectly, in the form of contributions to TRBC, the complaint alleges. Jerry Falwell Sr., the famed and controversial leader of the religious right, founded Liberty in the 1970s and spent a decade promoting the school. When he died in 2007, the school received $29 million in life insurance benefits, which rescued the school from debt. Falwell Jr. alleged in his July complaint that the school no longer had permission to use his father's image. The school contested, filing a motion in late August to have the suit dismissed, arguing, among other things, that Falwell Jr. did not have authority to sue on behalf of the family trust, as his brother and co-trustee, who was also Liberty's chancellor, did not consent. The initial trademark lawsuit consisted primarily of a list of examples of how the school was using Jerry Falwell Sr.'s name and image. After the school filed its motion to dismiss the case, Falwell Jr.'s attorneys filed an amended complaint, making a series of allegations about misconduct by school leaders, including through a series of questionable self-dealing transactions that have the appearance of kickbacks, and overlooking sexual misconduct by former leaders. Our last article was published by the Religion News Service on September 15, written by Jack Jenkins. March for Our Lives, Faith Leaders Calling Florida Lawmakers to Cease and Desist. On September 15 in Florida's capital, a phalanx of college students ventured to the statehouse to deliver a letter that, in part, protests the murder of three black patrons by a white gunman last month at a Dollar General store in Jacksonville. The students are members of the local chapter of March for Our Lives, a gun violence prevention group co-founded by David Hogg, a survivor of the 2018 mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School near Miami. Last year, students from March for Our Lives stood on the same state house steps in Tallahassee and recalled the names of victims of a litany of recent school shootings as part of a national wave of demonstrations. But the September 15 demonstration, the start of 2 days of protest, the students were allying with a coalition of faith-based organizations, such as Repairers of the Breach and the Florida Council of Churches, to demand state leaders do more to address not only gun violence, but also voting rights, racism, poverty, LGBTQ discrimination, and other causes. It's not enough to talk about how somebody gets a gun like the shooter at my high school, said Hogg at a rally at the First Presbyterian Church in Tallahassee before the march. We need to talk about how the shooter at my high school had a history of racism and racist comments, of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. The letter the groups delivered, a cease and desist letter addressed to Governor Ron DeSantis and the members of the state legislature, is part of an apparent national strategy devised by organizations associated with the Reverend William Barber, a Disciples of Christ minister and prominent anti-poverty activist. It bears the hallmarks of the Poor People's Campaign, an effort Barber co-chairs, which has long used faith-based rallies and protests to advocate for issues they see as interlocking, such as climate change, voting rights, racial justice, and the plight of the poor. In mid-August, repairers of the breach, founded by Barber, and the Poor People's Campaign helped organize a cease and desist letter addressed to the members of the North Carolina State Legislature. The letter, which organizers said was released to correspond with the 58th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, denounced efforts to pass what they called monster voter suppression bills. Instead of addressing the crises of poverty and low wages, lack of health care, underfunded public education, voter suppression, and environmental collapse, you have chosen to use culture wars that engender hate to camouflage and distract from your true agenda, the letter to North Carolina legislators read. The Florida letter adds, as religious and moral leaders, along with the thousands who signed this letter, we are publicly calling on you to cease and desist or resign. The letter also expressed frustration with legislation passed in Florida targeting LGBTQ people, as well as new election laws that have triggered lawsuits, arguing that the statutes amount to voter suppression. You have introduced 9 voter restriction bills between 2020 and 2023, and 10 anti-LGBTQ plus laws in 2023 alone, the letter reads. 4 of the voter restriction bills passed, while 5 of the anti-LGBTQ laws passed. Barber's organizations have long zeroed in on voting rights, once staging a peaceful demonstration in 2021 where Barber, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, and others were arrested in Washington, D.C., while calling on U.S. senators to abolish the filibuster in order to pass voting rights legislation. But as the United States' widening political divisions are increasingly worked out in state legislatures, activist organizations are teaming up to apply pressure at the state and even local levels where laws involving guns, abortion, voting, and other issues are often hashed out. Barber said, it's time to take back the mic so truth and love and justice ring loud, not law, lies and division and hate. We need to get serious, mobilize, and speak out so division and hate do not have the last say in this democracy, in this moment of history. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.